Hi.
Hi.
So, what's this book about?
You didn't read this one either?
Well, I was gonna, but I accidentally read something else.
What?
Vogue.
I hated the book, all right? I have no idea what it's about, and the writer was clearly on drugs when he wrote it. I mean, it went on and on and on like it was written in a total hurry. If I handed in something like this, there's no way I'd get a good grade on it. I mean, it's boring and it's unorganized. And I only read 30 pages of it anyway.
Well, that was passionate, albeit entirely misinformed.
Who dares follow Miss Kelly's lucid analysis?
It's required reading.
With Tom and Stella.
Episode 99. Cyrano de Bergerac by Edmund Rostand.
Monsieur, your nose. Your nose is rather large.
Rather?
Oh, well.
Is that all?
Well, of course.
No, young sir, you're too simple. Why, you might have said a great many things. Why waste your opportunity? For example, thus. Aggressive. I, sir, if that nose were mine, I'd have it amputated on the spot. Practical. How do you drink with such a nose? You must have had a cup made especially. Descriptive. 'Tis a rock, a crag, a cape. A cape? Say rather a peninsula. Inquisitive. What is that receptacle? A razor case or a portfolio? Kindly. Ah, do you love the little birds so much that when they come and sing to you, you give them this to perch on? Cautious. Take care. A weight like that might make you top-heavy. Eloquent. When it blows, the typhoon howls and the clouds darken. Dramatic. When it bleeds, the Red Sea. Simple. When do they unveil the monument? Military. Beware, a secret weapon. Enterprising, what a sign for some perfumer. Respectful, sir, I recognize in you a man of parts, a man of prominence. Or, literary, was this the nose that launched 1,000 ships? These, my dear sir, are things you might have said had you some tinge of letters or of wit to color your discourse. But wit, not so, you never had an atom. And of letters, you need but three to write you down. A-S-S.
Hello and welcome to episode 99. 99 episodes of Required Reading with Tom and Stella, a podcast that is brought to you by the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network. This podcast is all about books and literature, and each month we will take a thorough look at one piece of literature we have both read and determine whether or not it is required reading. As always, I'm Tom Panneries, and with me is standing on the ramparts, fighting the Spanish. We know she won't get shot, is Stella. Hello.
Bonjour, je m'appelle Regina Phalange.
Oh.
Hello, it's great to be here. Do you know who Regina Phalange is?
Yes, Phoebe.
Okay, I hope so. If you don't know who Regina Phalange is, you all should stop listening now. You don't deserve to be here.
Nestle Toll House cookies or whatever it was. So how are you doing?
Doing okay. It snowed last week, which was such a blessing for me. Yeah, I had some days off of school and just watched the snow come down as I read. And because the temperatures have basically been between 20 and 30,
yeah,
the snow really hasn't gone away. The roads are clear, but I still see the white stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That brings me joy. And the Buffalo Bills are doing really well, though we have a scary game against the Baltimore Ravens.
Oh,
and I'm
God.
In Raven territory. Last Friday was quote unquote purple day to support the Ravens. And I wore my Josh Allen red jersey, and like I made many enemies that day. And you can guarantee that Friday is going to be a purple day, and it's going to be even worse because now we're actually playing each other because we weren't playing each other last week. But yeah, I'm ride or die Bills, and I just want for the Bills to win one Super Bowl because they had that crazy like 3-year stint where they just kept going and losing.
Yes.
But yeah, and I love Josh Allen. I think he's a great guy. So overall, I would say, yeah, mostly good. You know, tired, I think, just getting back into the rhythm of teaching after 2 weeks, getting the sea legs back. But other than that, yeah.
What's funny is we're recording this before the Super Bowl, but I'm pretty sure this is going to come out at or near the Super Bowl.
Oh, no.
So people are going to be like, if you only knew then. I think they're playing in Buffalo, right?
They are. Buffalo, so they have home field advantage, okay, with the Mafia.
Yeah,
there.
See, I'm pulling for Buffalo to win. I did like a bracket challenge where I picked Buffalo to win everything. So I'm just kind of I'm ready to see that. Last weekend that I was like, I can't believe that happened, was the Washington Tampa Bay game.
I've only seen highlights and it does look ridiculous. Great. Like a third string kicker. Yeah. And yeah,
I'm a Giants fan, right? We don't even follow a team closely at this point. We just kind of like watch football, but I've been a Giants fan since I was like 10. They're terrible. So at least they're not the Jets. I don't know. They're both those teams.
Yeah. Or the Patriots. No, the Patriots this year too are pretty bad. Yeah.
So, tennis is on. So I'm going to watch the Australian Open. So yeah. Anyway, but yeah, so, we're recording this in January, but this is going to come out around Valentine's Day. So I chose the book this time around, and I went for something that's known as a romantic story. And this is a really well-known, I mean, this is like, you mentioned this to people who know romantic literature, and I'm lowercase r, not capital R romantic. And they'll be like, oh, yeah, people know that Cyrano de Bergerac is like kind of a well-known love story, or at least the balcony scene. The conceit of Cyrano feeding Christian lines has been, and I'll get into it, it's a very well-known plot device, and it's been used time and again. What's your experience with Cyrano?
Yes, I'm pretty sure I've seen maybe the Steve Martin version.
Roxanne?
Yes, if not snippets. I've known of him. I've known of, you know, the big nosed man. I feel like there is maybe another version that I had seen as well. I did not see the one with Peter Dinklage, which I was recently reminded of that existed. I don't know that I will. I think I would probably just tend towards another adaptation. And I do believe that I've seen it performed live, with a friend who was in college at the time, or a friend's son who the son was also a friend. So I've had experience. I've never sat down and read it though. I don't think, though some things seemed awfully familiar, but I think it just seems like, yeah, I know this story really well. I think it is a story that people generally know, like, oh yeah, this is the thing that happens. But I always hope that there's a happily ever after, an HEA, if you will. And each time I sort of forget. And then as I get closer, I'm like, oh yeah, I forgot that, you know, it's not going to end happily, is it? So yeah, enough experience to go in with like background, but also kind of experience it for the first time.
Yeah. I was assigned this in my senior year of high school. So that was when I first read it. I had known about the play Cyrano. I'd known about the whole thing about, you know, the big nose, the balcony and stuff, but I'd never seen a production of it or anything like that, or even a movie version. We watched Roxanne in my senior English class, and I remember really loving it when I was in high school. Maybe I was just kind of this hopeless romantic back then or something like that. I don't know. So, but this is the third time I've read it, because I read it several years ago because I came across a copy in a book room or something. I was like, oh, I haven't read this in a while. And I don't remember what my opinion of it was back then. But we'll get into it now. So without further ado, shall I go into the background of the author and everything?
Please do.
Okay. I've got three bits of background here that I'm going to share with everybody. The first will be the author biography of Edmund Rostand, who's our playwright. Cyrano de Bergerac was actually a person. And so this is kind of a biographical piece. I don't know how accurate it is biographically, but it is a – whoever's playing Cyrano is supposed to be playing the actual Cyrano. So he's essentially doing that. And then I have just some information about adaptations, et cetera, some of the history of the play. My bio information for Edmund Rostan comes from the Utah Shakespeare Festival webpage, because they apparently put on a production years ago and they had a pretty good bio for that. So Edmund Rostan was born in Marseille, France on the 1st of April, 1868 to wealthy parents. He went to Paris to study law and he was admitted to the bar, but he became more interested in writing poetry. In 1890, he published a volume of lyric verse that received a few favorable reviews. The same year, when he was 22, Rostan married Rosamond Gerard, a 19-year-old poet and later distinction in the granddaughter of a marshal of France under Napoleon. Such personal associations with national glory, as well as Rostan's upbringing in southern France, perhaps accentuated a natural penchant for romance and grand eloquence. He published other poetry and soon became increasingly attracted to theater, to which he was devoted most of his future efforts. His first play actually to reach the boards was The Romancers, or Les Romanesques, in 1894, a charming if trivial satire and romance that was to achieve enormous success in New York over a half century later as the musical The Fantastics. Though it ridicules excessive romantic attitudes, the play itself is in sharp contrast to the drab naturalism of contemporary drama and presages the very mixture of imaginative romanticism, declamation, wit, and wistfulness that was to characterize Rostan's major works. Sarah Bernhardt starred 3 years later in Rostan's The Women of Samaria, La Samaritaine, in 1897. Here the triumph of ideal over physical love is dramatized in a biblical spectacle with a very human Jesus, speaking like Rostand himself, inspiring a new Magdalene to carry on his message, lead the mob to Jacob's well where Jesus waits and join in the Lord's Prayer. It was his next work, however, that elevated Rostand to the ranks of the great French playwrights. Cyrano de Bergerac brought him immediate and worldwide fame. Not yet 30, he was lionized at home. In 1900, Rostand was appointed officer of the Legion of Honor, and 3 years later, he became the youngest member ever selected to the French Academy. Rostand wrote his leading parts for great French actors such as Coquelin and Bernhardt. In fact, it was Bernhardt who played Napoleon's weak-willed son in Rostand's next work, The Eaglette, I'm not even going to try it. While this play did not create quite the furor of Cyrano de Bergerac, it enjoyed international success and consolidated Rostand's reputation. Ill health at this time caused him to leave admirers in Paris and take his family into retirement in a luxurious villa in Cambo in the southern countryside at the foot of the Pyrenees. He spent many years working on an allegorical animal drama that eventually became Chanticleer. The play was eagerly anticipated by a public that had not had a new Rostan drama for a decade. But though it has been praised by some critics as his most profound work, it never enjoyed the popularity of his preceding plays. In his last years, Rostan produced a verse pantomime, worked on a never-completed Faust, and almost finished a dramatization of another legendary character in The Last Night of Don Juan, La Dernière Nuit de Don Juan, in 1921. It was published posthumously because he died on the 2nd of December in 1918. Now, Cyrano de Bergerac, or Savinien de Cyrano de Bergerac, he was a French novelist, playwright, epistolarian, and duelist. Aha, I challenge you to a duel. His work was part of the libertine literature of the first half of the 17th century, so we have essentially about 250 years separating the actual subject and our author. He is best known, of course, for his inspiration as the character of the play. It includes element of his life, but also contains invention and myth. There's been a resurgence of study of Cyrano since the 70s, demonstrating the abundance of theses, essays, articles, and biographies published in France and elsewhere. His life is short. It's pretty poorly documented. Certain significant chapters of his life are only known from the preface to the Histoire comique par Monsieur de Cyrano de Bergerac, contenant les Estats et Empire de la Lune, which is the comical history of the States and the Empires of the Moon, which is published in 1657, 2 years after his death. Without Henry LeBret, who wrote biographical information, his country childhood, his military engagement, and the injuries it caused, his prowess as a swordsman, the circumstances of his death, and his supposed final conversion would remain unknown. There is real context, however, for some of the events in the play, such as the Siege of Arras in Act 4, which took place from the 22nd of June to the 9th of August in 1640 during the Franco-Spanish War, which had started in 1635. It was connected to the Thirty Years' War. A French army besieged the Spanish-held town of Arras, capital of the province of Artois, then part of the Spanish Netherlands. They surrendered after holding out for 48 days. Arras was held by a garrison of 2,000, commanded by Owen Roe O'Neill, an Irish exile in Spanish service. Despite a counter-blockade by a Spanish field army under Charles of Lorraine, which brought the French to near starvation, they were eventually resupplied, and the garrison surrendered on the 9th of August. It was ceded to France in 1659 in the Treaty of the Pyrenees, and has remained part of France ever since. The play's been put on many, many, many times. I'm going to skip over kind of things about productions of the play and go to some adaptations because I think, like I said at the top of the show, I think a lot of people know Cyrano through like references or adaptations before they've even read or seen Cyrano de Bergerac in some way, probably because they've seen like a sitcom episode or something where somebody does the I'm going to tell you what to say and you're going to say it and she's going to fall for you trick. So let's just go into some adaptations and talk about kind of the influence of this play, and we'll get into the play itself. So there is a musical called Cyrano. It's a 1973 adaptation by Anthony Burgess, starring Christopher Plummer, and he won a Tony Award for it, but it was a failure nonetheless, commercially. There have been numerous film adaptations of Cyrano de Bergerac, 1900, 1925, 1938, starring James Mason and Leslie Banks, 1946, 1950, starring Jose Ferrer, which is very known. There's a 1962 film starring Christopher Plummer. It was done by the BBC in 1968, 1974, starring Peter Donat, 1985, starring Jacques Jacoby, 1990, starring Gérard Depardieu, and a 2008 version starring Kevin Klein. Now, there are derivative versions, meaning that, like, they take their inspiration from it, but it's not a direct adaptation of Cyrano, or Kent isn't really considered one. A screenplay written by, of all people, Ayn Rand, called Love Letters. The 1985 movie Secret Admirer, written and directed by David Greenwald, which I own on VHS, because it was one of those movies that always showed up on like Comedy Central back in like the mid-90s or something. And I'd always end up catching it. It stars C. Thomas Howell, Kelly Preston, and Lori Loughlin as like the kind of love triangle. And the idea is that Lori Loughlin is writing all of these notes to Kelly Preston, but like, no, she's writing notes to C. Thomas Howell. But like, it's like he doesn't know she's the secret admirer, and then Kelly Preston, and the letters get mixed up among the families and everything, and a hijinks ensue. And Aunt Becky actually looks kind of cute in that movie. Yeah. There's Roxanne, as we mentioned really briefly earlier, which was starring Steve Martin. Daryl Hannah played the Roxanne character. Rick Rossovich, who was Slider in Top Gun, played the Christian character. Let's see, we've got Sajjan, a disabled poet, helps the brother from his adopting family fall in love with the woman he also loves by writing letters on his behalf. Duet, which is a 1984 Indian film. The Truth About Cats and Dogs, starring Uma Thurman and Janine Garofalo, I believe, which was kind of a gender swap that. Whatever It Takes, which is a 2010 film, starring James Franco. I Want to Marry Ryan Banks, starring from 2004, starring Bradley Cooper. Bigger Than the Sky from 2005, in which the protagonist auditions for a local community theater production of Cyrano de Bergerac, and the movie plays out with it as the background theme. Let's see, Megamind, inspired by the story and reimagining the characters in a superhero and supervillain format with the titular Megamind as Cyrano. Let It Shine, a 2012 Disney Original Channel movie loosely based on the story. The Half of It from 2020, it's a Netflix original that has Cyrano as a girl, Roxanne as a girl, and Christian as a boy. Cyrano, the 2021 film, a musical drama directed by Joe Wright. There are some TV episodes, and I'm not going to go through the whole list, but there's an episode of The Monkees with Peter Tork being the Christian and his three bandmates being the Cyranos. It's called One Monkey Shy. Cyrano de Brady, in 1972 episode of The Brady Bunch. It adapts the balcony scene with Peter trying to woo his crush while being fed the right words to say from, of course, Greg, the ladies' man. The 1982 episode of Different Strokes, Cyrano de Jackson, which I probably saw in a rerun at some point in the 80s or 90s, adapts the balcony scene with Arnold feeding lines to his friend Dudley through an earpiece. And then the 1996 episode, Looking for Pamach in All the Wrong Places of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, is adapted from the story. There are references in movies such as Short Circuit 2, Roseanne, the episode The Nth Degree of Star Trek The Next Generation, the Blues Traveler song Sweet Pain from their 1991 album Travelers and Thieves begins with a reference to Cyrano de Bergerac. There is a reference to Cyrano de Bergerac in the Spin Doctor song Little Miss Can't Be Wrong. I would be neglectful if I did not mention the very final episode of my so-called life, In Dreams Begins Responsibilities, because Brian Krakow pours his heart out to Angela Chase through a letter that Jordan Catalano gives to her. And at the very last scene is him slipping up and saying, "No, I meant every word." And then she gets into the car with Jordan, and I have never recovered.
Oh, you were a fan of the Krakow?
I was the Krakow in high school. So, ready for the plot synopsis?
Oh, I'm ready.
Yeah, this is a little bit long, so I apologize in advance. My source is Cliff. The curtain rises to show the interior of a theater. Several spectators are present, waiting for the play to begin. Their conversation informs us erroneously that this is the famous theater in which Cornell's Le Cid was introduced. The play tonight is Barrow's Clarice, and the leading actor is Montfleury. Ragueneau and Librette enter, and Ligniere calls attention to the fashionable people who were present. They wonder where Cyrano is, since he has forbidden Montfleury to act on stage. When Roxanne enters, Kristen points her out to Librette as the woman with whom he was in love, even though he does not know her name and has never talked to her. Ligniere says that de Guiche is also interested in Roxanne, and though she is resisting him, he is very powerful and a vindictive man. He's also married. Before the play within a play begins, Christian goes to warn Ligniere, who has left the theater, that his latest poem has offended a highly placed person who has stationed 100 men near Ligniere's street to ambush and murder him. The curtain rises. Montfleury enters on stage. As he begins to speak, Cyrano's voice interrupts and tells him to leave the stage. Cyrano offers to fight anyone who wishes to defend Montfleury, but there are no volunteers. When the manager of the theater asks Cyrano if he is also going to force him to refund the money of the patrons, Cyrano tosses a bag of gold to the stage, and the manager is happy. An affected gentleman who wishes to insult Cyrano says, "Your nose is very large." Cyrano then goes on to describe to him what a number of different types of people might have said about his nose. Then he says that while they duel, he will compose a ballad and thrust on the last line, and he proceeds to do just that. When almost all the spectators have left the theater, Cyrano confesses to Librette that he is in love with his cousin, Roxanne. Roxanne's duenna, or female chaperone, comes in and makes an appointment with Cyrano for the next day. He is ecstatic, and when he learns of Ligniere's plight, he happily goes off to fight the 100 men. The next morning, Cyrano waits for Roxanne in Ragueneau's pastry shop. He writes a letter, thinking that he may simply hand it to her when she arrives, and leaves without waiting for an answer. When she comes, she confesses that she is in love with Christian. Cyrano is brokenhearted, but he promises that he will look after Christian for her. Now, he does not let on to her why he is brokenhearted, or that he is brokenhearted, so she does not know how he feels. All of Paris is talking of his exploit, though, Cyrano's exploit with the 100 guys, and De Guiche comes and offers to be Cyrano's patron, but Cyrano refuses. Christian joins the cadets of Gascon, the famed Gascony guards, and he and Cyrano become friends. He confesses to Cyrano that he loves Roxanne, but that he is afraid that he cannot express himself well enough to win her love. Cyrano gives him the letter that he himself had written to Roxanne and tells him to send it to her in his own name. And this is the beginning of the deception. Cyrano writes beautiful letters and makes up impassioned speeches that Christian memorizes. Roxanne falls in love with Christian's borrowed eloquence. At last, however, Christian tires of his role as Cyrano's mouthpiece. The company is leaving for the siege of Arras, and before he goes, he wants to woo Roxanne with his own words. Lots of woo in this scene. But he has underestimated the strength of her attachment to beautiful language and gets nowhere with her. Cyrano saves the day for him by hiding under the balcony where Roxanne stands and whispering words that Christian repeats. Soon, however, Cyrano's enthusiasm makes this unbearable, and he speaks aloud, but Roxanne does not know that he is not Christian who's speaking. A monk brings a letter from De Guiche to Roxanne saying that he is sending the regiment on ahead, but that he is remaining behind for one night in the expectation of meeting Roxanne secretly. Roxanne pretends that the letter directs the monk to marry Cyrano to Christian immediately, which he does, while Cyrano detains De Guiche. The marriage is not consummated, however, because the guards leave from the front and the orders of De Guiche to fight at the siege of Arras. During the siege, Cyrano finds a way through the lines and risks his life to get letters to Roxanne, purportedly from Christian. Much to the surprise of everyone, Roxanne appears, bringing food and news, which makes Cyrano's hopes soar and restores the morale a lot of them, because for much of the scene in the beginning of the siege, they're starving to death because they're all out of food and water. She has come, she says, to confess that she had first loved Christian for his beauty, but now that because of his letters, she has fallen in love with his spirit and his wonderful mind. This is a much deeper and truer love, and she is ashamed that she has been so shallow. Christian is an honorable man. He wants Cyrano to tell Roxanne the truth. Just as Cyrano is about to do so, though, Christian's body is carried in because he has been killed by the first shot fired in the battle. Nearly 15 years go by, and we find them mourning Roxanne in a convent. She has always carried Christian's last letter next to her heart. Cyrano comes to her each week and gives her a witty resume of the week's gossip. Today, however, he is late. One of Cyrano's enemies has managed to injure him by having a lackey drop a heavy log on Cyrano's head as he passed beneath a window. Cyrano's mortally wounded, but he comes just at sunset, as always, to give Roxanne her news of the outside world. He sits in his usual chair and begins, but then asks to read Christian's last letter, and Roxanne gives it to him. As he reads, she realizes that it is too dark for him to see the words, and that this was the voice that she had heard under her balcony on the wedding night. As Cyrano dies, Roxanne says that she has loved only once, but has lost her love twice. That is Cyrano de Bergerac. Stella, what'd you think?
Listen, I like HEAs. I don't know that I've read a couple smuts that didn't have an HEA, but that's because they had like a sequel attached to it. But I will say that I did enjoy this, but it was as a romantic at heart and someone who ships, you know, it is hard to read at times.
It's sad.
It really is. Yeah. And then I was looking at all these stage directions and thinking that was really the piece that I think sets it apart in a different time. Because I just wonder with adaptations how faithful they actually are on stage with everything that's going on. Because there's like a play within a play going on almost. And just wondering about the setup. So looking at all this, as well as how detailed like the backgrounds are and things. And I'm just like, wow, this is,
yeah.
I feel like I'm really transported. I think for films, it works perfectly because you can do all of that. But yes, I mean, to answer the actual question, yes, I did like that.
You know, stage directions, because they, like, we've read Ibsen, which has detailed stage directions painting the scenery of the room, as does Raisin in the Sun. And Tennessee Williams, of course, has a lot of descriptive stage directions. This I was actually surprised that it was, because I've been reading Shakespeare for the last 3 weeks in AP Lit. So, and Shakespeare is pretty skimpy on the stage directions and descriptions, right? So not as so you can leave it up to your imagination. Yeah. I like this too. You know, it was funny. I don't know about you. It took me a little while to get into it. Like the first scene or so with the play within the play and all the crazy things going on. And then the thing I struggled to read it a little bit. I was just like, what the heck is going on here? I can't remember then. And then once it started to pick up with the duel, the insult of the nose and the duel, then it kind of started to go off where it was supposed to go. It really picked up pace. I read this inside of like a day. I had a ebook copied from Libby. So I was just like blowing through it, because it has a very, like, the dialogue has a patter that is pretty quick, especially with Cyrano and his friends, Librette and all that and stuff. So I did enjoy this in the end. So.
Yeah. Except when Cyrano has his monologues that can go on for a bit, but those are the only times that I really like that one where he's like, no, thank you. Multiple times.
I love, if for nothing else, if I was like, if I didn't like the play, I knew I was going to tell you that I love the insult scene. I love the how he just tears this guy down by just basically being, here's everything else you could have said about my nose, instead of like, it's big and such. And I remember Steve Martin does it very well in Roxanne and such. And I do like the balcony scene. We'll get to that.
And the moon.
And the moon. So the play is very specific to a piece of French history. I suppose you could set it in a more modern context, but you'd have to figure out a way to, how is Christian going to die, right? If you're going to do a straight up adaptation of it. But you know, it is a specific person, a specific part of history. It's very, and the specific part of history is honestly very Three Musketeers. We were talking about this before the break. There's references to Richelieu and such, and it seems to be around that same area. So I'm picturing Cyrano, you know, he's got the plume and everything. So it's very swashbuckly and such. That's not exactly in favor these days. We don't see a lot of swashbuckling movies that aren't about pirates, but this play seems to keep enduring. Like, why do you think this play has endured for the last 130, 40 years?
I think because the tale itself, perhaps apart from the history, is something that I think average Joes like you and I can really relate to. This isn't like The Bachelor or The Bachelorette, where everyone is super attractive. You know, like, there is a really attractive guy, and you kind of feel for him too, because he thought that he had someone that liked him more than just being attractive. But you got this person who, I guess in terms of our beauty standards, would potentially be considered ugly, but he has such a great soul, in terms, I want to be careful not to call him a good man, because he does get into a lot of brawls and duels. But his, like, soul is so beautiful in terms of how creative he is, how well spoken, and what a great writer. But that we just don't look often on the inside of people initially. I mean, if you think about dating apps, you know, thank goodness Tom's not on them. I mean it in the way of, like, I hope no one's ever on them. That's, I'm unfortunately on them. So this is stuff. Why. What?
That's damning with faint praise. Passive aggressive.
No, it just means I don't want anyone to be on them. It's just, it's a terrible, I now send pictures to people of, like, things that I've gotten, prompts and stuff. I'll tell you one very briefly. One guy said that, like, his previous girlfriend, because my name is Stella, obviously, his previous girlfriend was Heineken, and he something saw, it was like another one, and then he also dated a Budweiser, and I'm like, why is this the first line that you think that I'm going to become interested in you? Because of the Stella.
Like, what?
I don't know. But that's just what I'm dealing with. But anyways, but the whole point of me bringing up the eight naps is that it's so, you're, like, consuming other people. It's very much like swipe left, swipe right, that people don't really tend to look more for who are these people on the inside, reading their prompts, etc. And I know they don't, because we definitely don't match on things when I see who's liking me. And so I think that's like the lesson of this, is that people immediately look at outward appearance and don't get to know the person on the inside. Not necessarily saying that Roxanne did that. I think maybe because she loves Cyrano, I think, throughout, but it was more of an agape love, I think, than an erotic love. Mm-hmm. But I just think that that's a story that will always endure. Like, as long as there are human beings breathing and love is a factor, that I think we will always, there will always be people that struggle in this particular way. And you can dress this play up, even though I talked about those stage directions, you can dress this play up however you want. And you proved my point just with the list that you went through with the adaptations. Yeah. And how varied they were.
I like the fact that this isn't like a Pygmalion, My Fair Lady, She's All That type of scenario where the like an ugly duckling is actually a swan type of thing. It is played out in a much different way. And I think you said it really eloquently about like what the love in this story means. Thankfully, I'd never been on a dating site because I met my wife in 1996. So there you go.
You really lucked out. You saved a large piece of your soul. Yes. Not having to endure this.
Yeah. You know, the character, what's interesting is that like Cyrano is the soul and Christian is the looks. And Christian is, at least in the beginning, is, or when he's with Roxanne and trying to be on his own, is like kind of a himbo. like there's not a lot to him, even though he is a very kind person. He doesn't seem like the type of arrogant person. And the interaction they have where he's like, I'm going to go it alone. And he's just like, hey, baby, is like really, really awkward. And I'm reminded of a movie, of an adaptation of another play that we did, which was the very end credits scene or mid-credits scene of the movie Rosaline, where Romeo and Juliet are escaping on a boat, and then like they have nothing to talk about. That's what I was reminded with the scene with Christian trying to actually talk to Roxanne without Cyrano's help. But no, I agree with you. There is something about what our physical attraction to one another and what goes on in somebody's soul, and when they feel that they are not gifted in that particular way. And I wonder how you would make, you know, I'm sure you could make this again these days and such like that. But I was seeing a discussion the other day. It was either in a podcast or in an article about the way Hollywood's always been shallow, but like Hollywood seems to be casting more and more and more attractive people into roles to the point where like you turn on a television show, especially television, and there doesn't seem to be an ugly person on screen. Not that there ever were, but like, it's just, there's the normality of people seems to be gone from productions on our television screens and things like that. And you mentioned The Bachelor, which I think I only ever endured one season of, which is a terrible show. Of course, I decided to watch Temptation Island. So.
And Love is Blind is like huge. I only watched, I think, one episode. I was like, I can't do this unless someone else is watching with me. Yeah. So I don't think I'll ever watch it. But that kind of stuff is big. But again, you look at everyone and they're like, not just conventionally attractive, they're like really beautiful people. Mm-hmm. And you wish that shows existed of maybe conventionally attractive or like average looking people to give us like hope. Because when I watch that, I'm like, okay, well, there's no hope for me because these people are having trouble. Well,
they're also trying to. The other thing is that all those true people are like, they're I don't know if they, how they're auditioning for them, but I know they're like grabbing a bunch of them off of Instagram, which, you know, so it's like it's the collision of the beautiful people and influencer culture and such. Love is Blind is definitely a good show to watch with somebody so you can tear it apart.
Yeah.
The most recent season we didn't get all the way through because it was really boring.
So. Oh, see, I thought, was that with the physicist and the chemist?
Maybe.
I thought people really liked that one.
That might have been two seasons ago. I don't remember. They were in DC, I think, for this particular season.
Yeah, I thought people liked this one. Oh,
we didn't get through it. Okay. You know, it's a matter of subjective, matter of taste.
Sure. So.
Okay. back to this.
We're
totally off topic. So let's talk about the play itself and just like how it is written, because Rostan seems to be towing this line between comedy and tragedy, because it is quite funny in places. And I think a lot of the things in the first act are meant to be comical. And I started to laugh when I could start picturing the way it would be staged. Because there was a point where it's like, this is like, I'm not getting what's going on. And I started to picture, okay, like, what would this look like on stage? Because it's written to be performed, right? It's not written to be read. And once I could picture like kind of this hubbub and zinginess going around and going on and confusion and all this back and forth, I'm like, this could be really, really funny as a production. And yet it's tragic at the end. So like, where is he towing the line? Where do you think it falls? Does it succeed? Does it fail? What's your take on this tragic comedy, essentially?
Yes, I think he would like it to be. I think it does a good job of towing the line. I feel like there's almost this darkness underneath the surface throughout. Mm-hmm. That even with some of the humorous moments that are happening, even with the funny lines, that there's still like a sadness involved with it because of what Cyrano has to endure. And we know that when people joke, you know, part of it is truthful. And so I think that he has had to, when you hear him go through that particular monologue of like, you could have said all these things, chances are he heard all of those things. And this is a man who's had to live with that, you know, his entire life, and probably has had to build that up. So he has gotten to a place where he can kind of survive. However, he still does duel people whenever they look at him the wrong way or mention anything. So I always think that even in the jokes, there's like a sadness, a grief or maybe a darkness underlying everything. And then we go to the end. You know, I think Christian is like the first big one that, you're like, oh, wow, the stakes are actually higher maybe than I expected. Maybe I thought going in that this was a rom-com and everything was going to be okay. But when Christian dies, I think that you get hit. And that potentially prepares you for the big hit at the end. Mm-hmm. I wonder how it would feel if Christian hadn't died and then Cyrano dies at the end. I don't know if it would be as impactful because Roxanne would have been in a happy situation, because everyone's really sad. Yeah. Anyways, it's like, oh, here's yet another tragedy that will fill there. So I think he does a good job. I think he kind of hides the tragedy until the most poignant moments, and he waits for it. You know, it's not just they all go off, they say charge, and Christian just happens to die in that particular rush. Christian has gone off so that he can give Roxanne and Cyrano space, so that Cyrano can confess that he's the one writing letters and he loves Roxanne. And then he dies, and then Cyrano's like, I can now never say that I was the one doing this and I'm the one who loves Roxanne. So he really chooses the best moments for these terrible things.
He does. And even so, like, as he gets us into the act, it's a play in five acts, by the way. And act four is the war. Act five is the convent. And act three is the balcony. And we go from the balcony to the war. But he allows some comedy in act four, because there is still the sort of spirit and there's some sink with food, and they're like kind of on de Guiche is there, and so it's not all heavy until you start to get into, like, even when she arrives, it's like, hey, you know, and it's kind of fun. You know, something bad is going to happen. It's war, it's terrible, but there's like a fun going on in the moment. But you know that he's not making a farce of war. So like, I think he really does toe that line really, really well, until you dip into where Christian gets killed. And then there really is no humor left in the play, because there doesn't need to be, because the last act of the play, which is the convent, is very solemn and, mm-hmm. Rightfully so. And then that just kind of the heaviness of Christian, having gone and what that did to her 15 years later, she's still in mourning, and he comes in, and then we find out, and this is the guy we've been kind of rooting for the whole play, right? You know, and he gets hurt and he's dying. And she just finally realizes that I've lost my love twice, and it's such a sad ending, but I think it's very well earned.
How do you mean by that?
Well, you ever watch a movie that blends pathos and humor, and yet the pathos, it's too funny, so the pathos never actually, like, so when they get to the things that where the pathos is and such, it feels like it feels tacked on. Or it feels like, you know, you got way too jokey, so this doesn't balance it out, or you haven't led into this well. A really good example of this is Thor: Love and Thunder, where, like, there's that whole underlying line of Jane Foster being sick and all this stuff, yeah. But everything is a gag. And by the time we get to the tragedy of the story, I'm like, you didn't earn this because all you did was gags. So, and I like Taika Waititi. I like What We Do in the Shadows. I really did enjoy Thor Ragnarok. I thought that was a really good movie. But Love and Thunder, I was like, what? You know, I was just, it was really, really uneven. So by the time you get to the really sad part, it's like, no, you didn't earn this. You were farting around with silliness the entire time, and now we're supposed to take it seriously. Rostand balances it out, like you were just saying. All right, so let's talk about our main character, Cyrano. What do you make of this guy?
What do I make of him? I'm trying to think if I would want to hang out with Cyrano. Cyrano is, and there's some, like, click, but, like, nationality click. How would you even? It's certainly like an exclusive society. That's something that I didn't fully understand. The Gascons, uh-huh. And I guess just that they kind of keep to themselves. But he's not only a. I would say that he's a complex character because he's got his self consciousness about his nose.
Yeah.
Which I think all of us could pick something out that we are, you know, conscious about and are constantly kind of looking and, oh, no, are they thinking about that sort of thing? I think that he's a good friend towards not only his military men, but other people that might not be in that particular legion. I think about the baker, who I think technically was in that particular squad, but he tells that his wife – you know, the baker's a good man. You better stop your philandering with the musketeer, which unfortunately she ends up leaving with the musketeer. But just to know that someone is, you know, looking out for a friend like that, and to go against his own self-interest, I think that right there points to how great a character he is and potentially a kind man. In that he is so in love with Roxanne, but he is willing to, but he loves her in the way of, in the right way. I think that you want the best for that person that you love. And if that means that you can't be that person for them, or you need to sacrifice in some way, I think that's like the truest form of love. And he does that for her, that he recognizes that she's in love with Christian, and she says, can you protect Christian? And so he has to do it. So I really enjoy him as a character. I do enjoy his funny moments as well as the moments where he is serious as well. I think just like you said with Thor: Love and Thunder, if he were just joking all the time, I think it would maybe grate on my nerves. But there are some solemn moments here in his speeches as well. And also, I think, like I said earlier, you need to take a step back and see what he's saying about himself jesting, because I think he also believes that to a certain degree about what he looks like and who he is.
Yeah. I agree with all that. I think sometimes when he does get poetic, especially when he's showing off to his friends, he gets a little bit verbose. So he can be a little much, and I see, but I see what I see is this is actually an interesting psychological profile too. So this is a character that you could really dig into, like what is motivating him and what is driving him, and the nature of insecurity, right? And one thing is, like, obviously you were saying, the humor is masking some things, or it's its way of expressing certain things and such. And the insecurity is that. And you notice how the humor really comes out around the other men in a big way, right? Like, he's funny and stuff around Roxanne, but he's not showy and over the top around her. Like, in fact, when he talks to her one-on-one, it's a lot more natural. And then with Christian, he's encouraging. So he has the ability to be more than just kind of the jokester. But when he's with when he has the audience of the men and everything, it's almost like I don't want to say he's overcompensating, but he is compensating in some way for the fact that he's insecure about, like, his nose and the way he looks and stuff. And I think that was very well portrayed, that type of personality trait, because very often you don't get that sort of depth in characters. The other thing is, and I'm glad you pointed out the fact that Roxanne asks him to help Christian, and he legitimately does it. It's not like, because I think we've seen too many TV shows and movies where, like, we get these sort of help the guy out, but I'm going to basically sabotage the other guy or the other woman to get the person in the love triangle. You know, like, I'm going to mess with something or whatever. And there's no ill intent toward Christian. There might be a little bit of jealousy, but he's honorable in that way. And that's a rarity these days. Right. So, what about Roxanne? Like, what is your take as her as a female character?
She seems rather one-dimensional to me because she's only there as an object, really, mm-hmm. for two men to pine after. The one thing that might go against what I'm saying is what she did for the army, that she snuck in and also brought food. But of course, her original intention was to sneak in to see Christian. But it was nice that she brought food for the legion that was, or the garrison that was starving to death, it seemed. Even at the end, like, she's in mourning. She's been in mourning for 14 years. She goes to a nunnery of some sort. For me, she does not have a lot of depth, unfortunately. I hate to say it.
No, I agree with you. And coming off having read Dracula, where we had Mina.
Oh, yeah.
Mina's a great – I like Mina as a – you know, Harker, a female character. I liked Lucy as well, despite her ultimate fate. But yeah. I thought Mina had a lot more depth and a lot more agency, and her bravery where it is and is good. And you have other characters in 19th century literature that are women who are a lot more three-dimensional and the object of desire or love. You know, we could throw around a few, but not physically, you know, metaphorically speaking. And but the Roxanne really doesn't have much else to do except for fall in love with Christian, watch Christian die, and then realize Cyrano is the one all along. But then again, the only character with any real depth in the story is Cyrano, right?
Yeah.
Because Christian's one-dimensional as well. He's a nice guy. He's not an arrogant dude, bro. He does the honorable thing in the end. In his end, like he goes to fight, but he says to Cyrano, like, you need to tell her, and leaves them to it. And then, of course, he goes over the line and shot immediately, but which sets up the whole thing. But he's essentially a plot device as well. So. but Cyrano is the only one that we spend enough time with or get enough lines out of to see more than just serving a single purpose. And I think that's actually pretty interesting. Do you think that's like a plus or a minus with this play?
Which part?
The fact that Cyrano really is the only three-dimensional character. And I may be simplifying, but it's kind of jumping to me that, like, yeah, he's the one we know the most about, and even the other two main characters
yeah.
really aren't that well developed.
I guess I'll do a cheap thing and say it's both and. the play, you know, the play is named Cyrano, and so, yeah, let's expend all of our time on this man and really put a lot of energy into him and make everyone care about him. And because of all the other people involved, don't really have a lot of time for them. So let's not make it too cluttered. But at the same time, you don't want to read other characters that keep reappearing and not care about them. You kind of want some depth to the other people that are around him. Otherwise, you're like, why is this smart man hanging out with these yeah. duds? So it's a both and for me.
Yeah, he's kind of, it's, I do kind of wish they had developed her a little bit more. You need Roxanne to be a character worthy of that much attention and fuss, right? Because you could certainly do, she's played by a gorgeous actress or something, right? And all of a sudden, like, you write the character and the character is actually not all she's cracked up to be. And, you know, that's the whole lesson, et cetera. But this is not her. She's meant to be, like, to the end, the object of affection, but she's really only an object. That's kind of frustrating. I would have liked to see her with just a little more to her. You know, if it serves the story that she isn't that deep because we just need to focus all our attention on Cyrano, that's fine. But I see why Christian's attracted to her. And I see physically why Cyrano is attracted to her. But what is it about her that he's so in love with? Like, she's gorgeous, right?
Yeah.
That's I get. But Cyrano is deep. He has this, he's a poet. He's this soul and everything, and he's essentially just, she's the pretty girl. I had a crush on a gorgeous girl in high school. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's also the growing, they grew up together, right?
Yeah, I think they're actually cousins.
Yeah, because, I mean, I just flipped to a part because I was trying to see how she speaks, because mm-hmm. I think she is able to keep up with him in a way that maybe only his friend can keep up with mm-hmm. him. But he says to her, you still mother me. It might be one of those, like, young love, neighborhood girl, was it the girl mm-hmm. next door kind of situation? Yeah, it seems like they maybe complement each other to a certain extent as well. I think she does get his wit and she can give it back a little bit, but I couldn't find much evidence of that.
I seem to recall that as well. I'm sitting here thinking, like, I wish we had a little bit more of it, you know?
Yeah. Oh, I will say there is that one scene where she's tricksy. She does trick the man that does want to marry her, whose position I've forgotten. Yes. She tricks him by tricking the guy, the monk, or the man from church
yeah.
who comes.
I think it's supposed
and,
to be something like, he's from a monastery, so I just thought monk.
Yeah. And is quote unquote reading a letter, but doesn't, and then comes up with it very quickly. And she is able to trick Dagish as well. So she does seem to be a witty person. So there's my evidence. Yeah. And I do think, yeah, that maybe they complement each other. And just to restate, I think growing up with someone or a girl next door, that always has an allure as well.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. It's just part of me just wanted to see more of her. Almost like verbal sparring with Cyrano. I think it would just been in us, but maybe, and I'm thinking more of it in the Shakespeare way, like, you know, the back and forth and the pattern thing. I think that would have been fun. It's not against a knock against this play or against her as a character. But then I wonder, I was going to ask, is she completely clueless then? Like, how does they grew up together? Yeah. How does she not know? Or does she kind of know, but doesn't think of him that way? It's not really ever revealed whether or not she always knew. I think at the end she just kind of figures it out. But I could have sworn she could have had at least some sort of hint that maybe, unless he was really good at masking it. So what do you think?
Yeah, because that was, as I said, I guess at the top of this show, I sometimes forget that it ends this way, and then I start to realize it as we go. And I was thinking this read through, so I do wonder if I read it before, that, does she say, like, I've known, I've always known? That must be some other book or movie that I have watched. But it is odd, like, how does she not listen to, hear his voice, first of all, which he is able to modulate it to a certain extent, and he is whispering in the balcony scene. And we do know that he changes his voice during the moon crazy person mm-hmm. scene. But man, I just feel like you would know, you would recognize someone that you grew up with. And then the fact that he speaks as he writes, to a certain extent, I don't know. Maybe it was one of those things that she's like, she knows, but she's denying it. Mm. But then you have to ask yourself, why? I don't, is it because of the nose then? Like, I don't know. I would have expected, because we do know that both, I think, men and women are oblivious sometimes. I know that we like to generally say that it's men are oblivious, but we do know that women can be oblivious too. So let's share that, but no, it is kind of shocking. And perhaps she did, but she was, it was so like subconscious.
I agree. Yeah. Cause like, I think of like, I'm trying to think of, she might've been in some sort of denial or dismissive of it because at least when she was growing up, that's not what their relationship was like. And so it's not that she's taking him for granted, but it doesn't register because when she sees him, it's a totally different look. Right. And this is a trope as old as time. Like you can, and because it's true in real life, like you could be friends with somebody and not realize that you think of them in a sort of romantic way. And then one day it clicks. There's something, either they say something and you're like, wait a second, I feel like a totally different way about you. And then you start to realize, like, I kind of always have, but I was just not denying it, just kind of like oblivious to it or ignoring it. And, you know, maybe that's kind of what's going on here. She's kind of in that oblivious, ignoring sort of phase. One of the themes in here is obviously appearance versus reality. And there's the obvious example, right, of how it's expressed, Cyrano and Christian and et cetera. Like, what other examples do you see of where Rostand is playing with or showing us a statement he's making about the idea of appearance versus reality and how they relate to each other?
I don't know, Tom.
What about like the play within the play at the beginning and such, that he's creating some sort of illusions and things like that? Maybe it's a very English class question and I'm trying to parse through it at 9:30 at night after teaching for 2 days after a 3 week break. Because it's interesting. He tries to ground it in a real setting in history and things, but there's also maybe the arrogance masking the fear, the appearance of these gentlemen as they go off to war, where it's a lot less, sexy than it seems, right? Like they're, you know, I'm, like I say, I picture him in like a Three Musketeers type of uniform, and it's all for one and one for all. And there's a very, attractive look to it in that sense. And war, when we finally get to it, is dirty, right? And we know mm-hmm. we've read enough war novels ourselves and seen war movies and such to know that. But, you know, throughout most of the first three acts, we see a lot of posturing, a lot of kind of chivalry and these sorts of things that make it seem beautiful or sexy in some way to go off to war, to fight in the battles, to wield your sword and duel. Like, even the duel is supposed to be the scene where he's making the ballad and everything. So maybe he's setting up that appearance so that when we get to Act 4 and the reality of everything sets in, the contrast is to nail the contrast like that. And you said earlier that there is kind of a dark undertone to a lot of it. And I think playing that with the idea of appearance or putting up a front or putting on a show versus the reality of the situation helps contribute to that. But let's get to easily the most famous scene in the play, because it's probably one of the most well-known scenes in drama, right? Which is the balcony scene. So in the balcony scene, just to recap what happens is, you know, Christian goes to see Roxanne. He's like, I'm going to do this. I don't need you, Cyrano. Cyrano's with him. And he starts to speak to her. And she's like, who the heck are you? Where's this guy that I was like in love with from his writing? And then Cyrano starts feeding him the words. And eventually Cyrano just kind of takes over and does a good enough imitation of Christian for Roxanne to think it's Christian, and then they get married and everything. So that's the recap of the plot. Is this believable? If not, does it need to be believable? Is it as romantic as it seems as well? Because why I always think that, like, my teenage students would be like, ew, he's a stalker or something like that. He's a creeper. So is it real? Is it believable? Is it romantic? Like, what do you think? Like, do you swoon? is he pitching?
Well, what is more romantic than someone saying, like, I love you? So, you know, it gets to be a little too, like, she's asking for a lot. Mm. She's asking for a lot. But I think you can see her. This is why I think maybe subconsciously, you know, she does love or want it to be Cyrano, because she has these high expectations of how someone should fawn over her or declare their love, where saying I love you is not enough. And I think for Christian, what you see is what you get. You know, he is handsome and that's probably all you really get. But, like, he has these feelings. I love you. That's the way, you know, it should be. So I would say it's not realistic. I think it's over the top and dramatic, as it should be in such a play. And then what was the other question? Did I find it romantic? I guess once we get to where Cyrano was whispering up there and how he is describing the love, sure. You know, we do like, well, I say we, that might not be true for Tom, but we do like, you know, the Romeo and Juliet scene at the balcony as well, which really was what I was thinking about the entire time anyways.
I was going to ask how it compares to that. What do you
think? Yeah. But of course, Romeo is both Cyrano and yes. Christian, because he is attractive and he is pretty intelligent and witty. So he is able to say all those things on his own without a mouthpiece in it. But yeah, my gosh, Roxanne really demands a lot. She gets bored if someone says, I love you.
That's it? Come on.
Yeah.
You give me more than that. I love you, please.
Yeah.
They break up. Cyrano's across the park holding up a boombox.
Oh, so, yeah.
Yeah, that poster's downstairs, not in here. That is one of my all-time favorite movies, by the way. Anyway. But yeah, no, I agree with you. But you're right. It's not meant to be realistic. It's meant to be an exaggeration and over the top and almost like pitching us an ideal of some sort, something we'll never actually measure up to, or at least something to know that it is almost fantastical in the way that, like, he is able to profess his love like this, and these scenes happen. But through the whole play, it's been kind of like that. There's always a showmanship aspect to it. In this case, it's a little more hidden. For what it's worth, though, I think it's a beautiful scene. And I think that if you get the right actor playing Cyrano de Bergerac, you can get a lot of, like, the heartache in him as well as the love. Like, you could have a good actor play these lines as if he is confessing to her how he feels and giving the whole romantic treatment there. But, like, if you play it with a little bit of pain behind it, because it's not you that's doing the talking, so to speak, I think it gives a really nice depth to the scene. And I think that's why I've always loved it. It's like, it's really bittersweet in places. As beautiful as it is. And I think the poetry is beautiful, or the dialogue is beautiful too. It matches what this character is supposed to be like and such. As far as that other play, I don't know if I like, there are times where I like this scene better than the balcony scene in Romeo and Juliet, but the balcony scene in Romeo and Juliet also shows something that's completely unrealistic, and it's supposed to be because it's the tragedy of these two, and he's pointing out, you know, the ridiculousness of this, et cetera, et cetera. And they fell in love so fast. So the unreality or the unrealistic aspect of the balcony scene where Romeo and Juliet is earned by how quickly they fall for each other in the previous scene, right? At the end of Act One, where they see each other at a party, and then all of a sudden it's love at first sight, and they're kissing, and then it's like, oh my gosh, like, who's Rosaline? And now I'm here with this wonderful girl, and they're going to get met. Like, they go from, like, zero to met. They go from kissing to marriage inside of, like, an hour. But it's meant to be like that, and we get that through that. And here it is the same thing. So I think they're almost, like, on an equal pedestal as far as balcony scenes, so to speak. I don't think there are very many other balcony scenes that I've read, so...
What do you think's worse? What do you think is worse? Yeah, Romeo and Juliet falling in love within a couple of hours, or all of that stuff going on Alien Romulus within a couple of hours?
Oh God! I think Alien Romulus is more intense. I can tell you that.
Yeah.
There's some face sucking in Alien Romulus.
Yes, there is. Just the unpleasant kind.
So I mean, here they get married. But the only thing that makes the one realistic thing about the balcony scene in Cyrano, just to get back to it, is the marriage, in a sense, because she's a war bride, right? And those of us who know people or were related to people in some way or another that were in the Second World War, there were a lot of men and women who got married. Like, they didn't know each other particularly well. They got married before he shipped out, and they were the woman at home waiting for him. My grandmother was like that. I don't know how long her and my grandfather had known each other before they got married. It might've been longer than a few days, but you know, she was a war. He was over in Europe for the war. So she had my uncle, and then she had, toward the end of the war, she had my dad. And, but that was the idea that, like, you know, so the fact that she would marry off so that he had somebody to come back to does make a lot of sense to me, as opposed to Romeo and Juliet just being impulsive, horny teenagers, and such. So, it would have been interesting had, like, if you just want to do a what if of, like, had Christian lived, what that would have been like. Would they have anything to, would they, like, when is the jig up, right? Like, how long does it take for her to realize, like, wait, something's not right here?
Well, I think had he, I hope that Cyrano would have gotten his tongue back and actually confessed it. And then it would have been down to Roxanne to figure it out or to decide between the two men. That would have been interesting. I don't know that I could say which person she would choose, though she did say that she fell in love with the soul of Christian. And if the soul of Christian is really Cyrano, then she would be a liar if she went with Christian.
Does Christian need to die in the play?
Oh, no, I don't think so. I don't think he needs to die, but I think, like I said, the value it adds to make it a play that does have stakes in it, I think it's not a death in vain. Though it is, when I read it, I'm like, this is silly. Like, he walks to the end of the camp. What did he do? Did he leave, like, the protective area? Like, what foolishness is this, Christian?
Yeah. I'm picturing somebody going over the trench and then getting shot immediately.
I hope he didn't do that. Come on. That's pure foolishness. Thought it was just going to be, like, within the walls of whatever their setup is. Yeah, so I don't know necessarily that he needed to die, but he did not die in vain because it definitely adds to the story.
Yeah, I agree with you. And also, like, we're talking about, like, how this earns its ending and the farcical nature of the beginning of the play. It's a counterweight to that, right? So if there's a lot of silliness and a lot of high energy stuff at the beginning of the play with the dueling and the play and the all these things, and it's happening one after the other after the other after the other, you need a heavy enough counterweight when you're doing the tragic parts. So somebody, I guess, does need to die, and it's Christian, and then she's in a convent for the next 15 years. Is that like I know it's just kind of like – it's kind of a plot device so that we can see like a reason for him to come see her all the time after all of this. I guess she really was that intensely in love with him that her mourning would be as intense. But then again, I'm not – I don't know if that's something that people in today's audiences would really understand, the whole idea of I'm just going to go get me to a nunnery and sit and live there and mourn for the rest of my life. You've had people who could be in mourning for significant points of time. And I suppose you could play Roxanne if you were putting this in modern day as somebody like this, but she'd have to function in society in a way that Roxanne here doesn't. And so it's just kind of, I think that's one of the more dated parts that doesn't translate as well.
Yeah. And I don't understand, like, she's not living by herself. When she's Roxanne prior to grief, isn't she living probably with her parents?
Yeah. She has like a caretaker.
Duenna. Yeah. How is this? And then she has the baker as a person. But how is she a woman of means that can be independently living?
No, she's I don't know if she is. That's why I was saying. So, like, I guess in the context of 1640, whatever, her going to the convent makes sense. I was saying that if you set this in 2024 or the 20th century or something, right? I don't know how well that would translate. You would probably have to change something about that. Have her mourning, but there, I don't know if she'd be sitting in a convent for the rest of her life.
Yeah, I get the convent. I just wonder what her life situation is prior to that.
Yeah.
Because I'm thinking maybe I'm just conflating it with English times, but like she wouldn't just be a single woman living by herself. So I wonder what's going on there. But I don't know where you go. Potentially maybe a clinic of some sort, maybe an asylum if you were that if you're that like grief stricken, potentially, like a sanitarium of some sort. I don't know.
Yeah. Or I just suppose if you wanted to do it like in the really just like, maybe if we're not shipping the woman off, but she's kind of sleepwalking through life, right? You could have the person who functions on a day-to-day basis, like she could go into work and feed herself and stuff, but it's just kind of numb to the world. And so the depression of grief and stuff like that, and you could set it, you have to set it up a little bit more other than, oh, look, she's in a convent. So, we talked about the end already. We talked about and such and Cyrano's death, which is odd. He's just like, it's not odd. He's attacked by, he still has enemies 15 years later, and he's attacked and he's hit. But I guess that we needed a way for him to like realistically look like he's dying suddenly, because she's been seeing him every day. So it's not like he could deteriorate like all of a sudden I have tuberculosis and I'm gonna die now. So he needed a quick death. And then I think the last word is like of the play is like my panache, right? His plume or something like that, which is kind of a good note for him to go out on, because it's very much him, right? But yeah, so I guess I'll just get to the last question. Is this required reading?
I think so. Backstage behind the scenes, BTS, at required reading, there is an idea I have for one of our specials to compare French, English, American, and Russian literature and kind of look at it, like taking, I guess, its standouts and look at how it's created and themes and the language, etc. And I think the reason why I'm saying this is because I think that this would be a good representation of French literature to potentially have as an example, along with, like, you know, Hugo, other things like Victor Hugo. Yeah, for sure. So I do think so. If not only because of the play and I think the theme surrounding and that it is ever relevant and talking about, you know, beauty standards, which I think is always relevant and is becoming more toxic as we go along with social media. I think also being a French play and getting insight into that culture through the language as well.
Yeah, I agree with you for all those reasons. Plus, like some other classic literature, I think you should read this at least once because of the way it is still alive and still referenced and still spoofed or used in our culture. So in the same way that you would read Romeo and Juliet, or you'd read the Odyssey, or you would read A Christmas Carol or something that has been done over and over again. They might not be directly adapting it, but they're doing a scenario on a show where somebody's feeding lines to somebody to woo somebody. If you should at least one time in your life read the source material and see where these things are coming from. In the same way that if you grew up like I did, seeing references to The Godfather in cartoons, I'm going to want to go see The Godfather to see where or Citizen Kane. And that you've got to finally go see the movie. And you're like, oh, that's where this comes from. And I think that's the Cyrano de Bergerac is a great example of that as well. All right. So we have a Christmas story comment from Facebook from Gene Hendricks of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network. Hi, Gene. He says about the Christmas story episode, that's 97. We'll have our episode 98 feedback in the next installment. He says, what's rather amusing is that after listening to this episode, which he had to download from the website, and I'll talk about that in a minute, I listened to episode 419 of The Way I Heard It, which is Mike Rowe's podcast. The only reason I could guess what the story was referring to in the beginning was the info that Tom gave out in this one. So He said, I would highly recommend it, that as a follow-up, as I learned some really fascinating things about one of the stories and its author covered here. Oh, okay. So a couple of notes from me regarding feeds and stuff. We are on Spotify, as I mentioned, and we remain on Spotify. The Tutor Freaks Apple podcast feeds kind of went belly up over December, and I finally figured out the way to fix what needed to be fixed. But I had to set up a completely new feed on Apple Podcasts. So if you haven't already, and you've been listening to this on the website, or you've been listening to this on Spotify and you want to listen to it on Apple, you have to resubscribe to the show because it's a totally different feed. You can search for Required Reading with Tom and Stella in the Apple iTunes library. It'll pop up. If you go to our website, there's a link directly to the Apple Podcast page. For this show note, this episode's show notes and the previous episode's show notes have the correct link in there. And I'm going to go, it'll take me a while because I need to, you know, there's 97 other, six other episodes. I'm going to try to fix those links to make sure everything is working properly and maybe even drop in the Spotify link as well. Also, we no longer have an account on Elon's House of Hate. We're over at Blue Sky at Rec Reading Cast for all your social media needs, which is like me posting the episode when I don't really do much with the feed as well. I need to learn some lessons on how to social media from Rob Kelly, who's got like five accounts and always seems to be participating. But yeah, so that's where you can find us out there. And I'll be changing a little bit in the outro to reflect that. But we got a big one coming up, Stella.
We do have a big one. And then after that, I'm looking for a new co-host because I think you've been canceled on the interwebs given some scandalous things you said in the last episode.
Honestly, I saw that. I'm like, what did I say?
Oh, you canceled. Yeah, big 100. Did you ever think when we first sat down in Starbucks to discuss starting this little show and then we did Of Mice and Men for episode number 1 that we would make it to episode 100?
Yes and no. Knowing that both of us have been long-term podcasters, and by then we were good friends too. You know, it's not like we had just met or anything. We'd been on each other's shows a few times. Several times by then. So it's like, oh yeah, we know each other well enough and get along well enough that we could do 100 episodes. But at the same time, 100 episodes of a podcast that's monthly is still a long time.
Sure.
So there's just that. It's like, you know, part of it's like, oh yeah, we could definitely do it. Can we make it? Apparently we have. So for episode 100, what are we talking about? Because it is a tangent special. So what's the special topic for episode 100, Stella?
Yes. And I thought since it is such a big number, that why don't we look inward at ourselves and pick out our top works of literature, just our favorites of things that we have read. Of course, there might be some overlap with things we've already chosen, but I think this would be like a really intimate look into us, hopefully for these years that we've done in 99 episodes, that people can kind of get an idea of who we are and our values and everything. But I think with this is probably really really special for us to talk about our favorites of books, literature, plays, anything's on the table.
I'm looking forward to it. This could be fun.
Yes.
So until then, again, check us out on Blue Sky Facebook. And don't forget to, you know, leave us reviews and everything. And as always, thank you very much for listening and take care.
And try to look beneath the surface of people that you are maybe quote unquote shopping for on the apps. Oh, try not to consume people, but actually look at their profile. That would be my great suggestion.
This has been a public service announcement.
Yes, you're welcome. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, which is brought to you by Two True Freaks. That's Two True Freaks. If you're interested in learning more about the books we've read or want to comment on the episode, follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/requiredreadingwithtomandstella.
If you would like to email us to comment on the episode or continue our discussion, you can reach us at requiredreadingcast@gmail.com. We will read every email we get on future episodes.
We're looking for more visibility, so if you liked this episode or the show in general, why not leave us a review in iTunes? Thanks again for listening, and come back next month for our next episode.